The SoCal Sound Sessions are listener and member supported. Please consider becoming a subscribing member. Click subscribe now at the top of the SoCalSound.org and make sure to choose live sessions from the drop-down menu.
And that is X and the Hungry Wolf from Under the Big Black Sun. And it was such a great track. I love hearing that. You know, we also heard earlier Burning House of Love live from Farm Aid, 1985. I'm Matt Pinfield in the studio right now with John Doe and Xene Cervenka. It's so good to see you, by the way, guys.
Good to be here.
Yes, nice to see you, too.
You know, I'm so excited about this final tour and this new record. You know, I've been seeing all the billboards around town. The end is near. You know what I mean? With X. And, you know, you've been a big part of my life. And I know many people who've been fans forever. I mean, could because I started in college radio in 1980. So it was right then when Los Angeles came out and became available. And, you know, and I was such a hungry guy for new music and punk and and just things in general. I just loved, I played everything. And fell in love with that first record from the get-go. So I just wanted to say it's really great to be here with you, full circle. Now, you guys are getting ready to release the ninth studio album, but it's your final one. So it's called Smoke and Fiction, and we're going to hear a couple tracks from it today. But can you tell me about the decision? You've reformed a couple times, and then when you did Alphabet Land, it was the first record with original lineup in about 35 years. But can you tell me why you decided this is the time to do a final tour and give it a break?
Well, it just we're one of the only still all original member bands.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long nobody knows how long you have in this planet, right? And yeah. So we figure, you know, odds are this is our last record. And so we said, yeah, let's just do that. Let's just make it our last record and let's play as long as we can and stop. Because, you know, you get to the point where that's all you can do. It's hard. It gets harder and harder. So, but I think the record came out great. And when you finish making a record and it comes out great and you love it and you're really happy with it, then you think, yeah, we could do that again. But chances are we won't. So please enjoy this new record and this tour and come see us while you can.
Yeah,
that's what I got to say about it.
Yeah, you've got a sold-out show at the Troubadour coming up. Mm-hmm. And then two more shows at the Regent and then a huge tour. Tell me about
you. I think as far as like last, I thought that Alphabet Land would be the last record, which that was in 2020.
Yeah.
And, but then somebody, I don't know, I got a call from our manager or maybe Xene and said, you know, we're making a new record. And it's like, we are? What? Shouldn't I be consulted about this? It's like suddenly we're making a new record. It's like, oh, well, damn, I guess we better get, hey, Xene, I guess we better get to work on this
yeah,
thing.
Well, yeah.
And as the, you know, lyrics were coming together and as the music was coming together, this would be the beginning of 2023. It was retrospective, not nostalgic, but it, you know, there were some looks back on images and situations and experiences that we had. The song The Big Black X is like that, which is a new song. So it's like, yeah, go out if you're going to go out. And this isn't like last tour, maybe through 2025.
Yeah.
But we're just going to like not tour as much. We're not going to play, your typical 500 black box rock and roll place. Yeah. We will up until next year. But after that, we'll play, you know, instead of playing 60 or 70 shows a year, we'll play 20.
Yeah.
Hopefully in nicer places. And so if you want to see the sweaty rock and roll deal, that's what's happening.
Yeah. These are such funny conversations. It's like, and then we're going to do this. And then this is going to happen. And it's like, everybody knows you cannot plan the future. I don't know. I know we're here right now, and that's all I know. I hope that we can keep playing till the end of the year. That's my goal.
Yeah.
But yeah, who knows?
Then there's a big asteroid that's headed towards the planet.
Right, exactly. And all of the other craziness that's happening, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
But we never know what tomorrow brings.
That's no, we don't.
I always say to people, I'm like, the only thing I know for sure is I don't know anything. I mean, I know about some things.
Yes.
Certainly love music more than anything and the people in my life. But when it comes to what's going to happen in half an hour, I'm not even sure. But I want to go back. You know, I'm going to play a couple new songs. But can we talk about it? Because what I love about The Big Black X is, and we're going to hear it, is it talks about all these places where you guys were playing, and it just paints an incredibly technicolor picture, a vivid picture of what life was like to be in the band back in that period of time. You know,
yeah.
You
were kicking things off. That's been our thing. Yeah. Images, and all of our songs are somewhat autobiographical, but they all have stories and images.
Yeah.
And it's not general, like a lot of pop music, God bless it,
yeah,
can appeal to everybody because it's, you know, very general about the images that it has. So
yeah.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, for us, I'll speak for myself especially, since I never really stopped doing music, or, you know, I think we had a few break periods, but not much. So it wasn't like we did something a long time ago and now we're going to come and try to recreate it. 40 years later, we're back together. It's not that. So it's not nostalgic. It's just kind of like a continuation. Like when I think about the Big Black X song, it was fun writing it because I could see all those things and all those people. The thing that you can't see are the faces that I saw writing the lyrics that were there when this was happening and there when the, you know what I mean? Like I could see those people as if they were alive. But the other thing is, like, I just kind of think, like, oh, I want to go back to that restaurant. I wonder if it's still there. That's yeah. kind of triggers those things. I don't live in L.A., so I don't go there very often. When I go, I'm immediately really sad because everything I cared about seems to be gone, and it's so full of homeless people and drug people, and it's just so tragic and sad what's happened to the cities. And then all of a sudden, it's like, yeah, okay, and then what? Well, let's do this. And then it becomes kind of like a cool place again. You get past that little jolt when you first get there that,
yeah,
where am I? But it's still a great city, and it's so much fun. Now that song does talk about some other places too besides LA, but
yeah, I mean, I think what's beautiful about it is, I mean, it just, like I said, and there's these images in there about phone booths and AM radio dedications, mm-hmm. which is really cool. I also love the letters hanging from the Hollywood sign.
Yeah,
and
remember
the,
that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the Earl Flynn Mansion, mm-hmm. right? Which you tell me about this. So as punks, it was abandoned.
It was probably an urban myth. Who knows? It was like this abandoned. There was just like a swimming pool and some like abandoned foundation, or maybe
it wasn't really a
mansion.
It wasn't even a house. It was just like it's part of the foundation, and it was just like, oh, go up this street and turn left, and then turn. I mean.
Crawl just up a hill.
Figure it out.
Yeah.
And be there. It's on Saturday or Sunday. Bring whatever you want to consume. And good luck.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the police showed up, and there was a helicopter at some point and things like that because there were too many kids having fun.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Metro Squad said no fun.
Especially back then, it was almost like a return to the ride on Sunset Strip in 1967 or 66.
Kind of a continuation. Yeah. But
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so I want to ask you, like, when you put out the first single and you got signed by Danger House, which was a small label that didn't last very long, right? But can you tell me about, I'd like to hear you talk about when you came together and realized that there was a new groundswell of things happening. And you guys were really at the forefront. There were a few, there were quite a few bands, but it was very few at that period of time. And how did that come together for you?
Oh, I don't know. Somehow we heard about The Mask, and I went down there. I don't know if Exene was with me, if we were there together, but I remember meeting Billy Bones and Brendan Mullen. Billy Bones was in The Skulls, and he's still around. I think they still play from time to time. And it was in a basement. And so, okay, and there's that. And then Tomato to Plenty and Tommy Gear from the Screamers were around, or maybe at the Copper Penny or some other diner. And, oh, look at that guy. They look like a kindred spirit. So it was in Hollywood, and there's weirdos in Hollywood, but these were a particular kind of weirdo.
Yeah.
And you thought, okay, they get me, I get them, let's do it. And Exene and I met at this writing workshop down in Venice, and la la la. I mean, all that's pretty well documented.
Yeah, I mean, it's been...
But it was like any place, any kind of a scene.
Yeah.
Things just happen. They happen organically, and nothing was contrived or premeditated. It just all kind of fell together, and we're really fortunate that we've made it this far, and that had some resonance. You know, people say, "Oh, what was it like?" It's like, well, you can listen to this song,
or
you can listen to all those songs,
yeah,
or whatever. But
yeah, yeah, which is so great. I'm going to play the Big Black X for everybody right now. You got to hear this song. It's a great track. I really want people to hear it because it's from the new album, Smoke and Fiction.
Get your cassette recorder and so you can record it over the air.
Remember when we used to do that? Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Here's X. We're in the studio with John Doe and Exene Cervenka right here at 88.5 the SoCal Sound.
Yeah,
right. That's from Wild Gift, of course, and White Girl. What a great song. 88.5 the SoCal Sound. Love that track. And always have. I think it's one of the, might have been one of the, I definitely played it on my first show here. I know I did because it's for some reason, I always end up playing. I've always loved that song. We also heard the live version there of Johnny Hit and Run Pauline and from Los Angeles. You know, guys, it was amazing that the first album was about 19 minutes long, right? I mean, it was nine songs. How long was it?
It was 10. I know it was nine songs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was
some over of the songs 20 were, minutes.
Some of the songs were a little longer because we had Ray Manzarek play on it as well.
Yeah. How was that experience? I mean, were
it was amazing.
You guys
were amazing. I mean, Ray was and still in my mind, like bona fide rock star. I mean, he's up there with, you name it.
Yeah.
You know, Keith Richards. I mean, the Doors were hugely popular and great, and they were, you know, one of my favorite bands. I couldn't believe it when he saw us at the Whiskey and said, oh, I'd like to work with you guys. Like, what the hell? What?
Yeah.
No.
That was so cool. I mean, and then you guys did Soul Kitchen, which was great. But I love the fact that he wanted to produce you guys. I mean,
we were playing Soul Kitchen before he saw us. And his wife, Dorothy, while they were sitting at the Whiskey, said, oh, Ray, look, they're playing your song. And he goes, what? They are? Because we played it so much faster, had nothing at all to do with their version of it. And, of course, his wife could listen a little better than he could. He really talked the talk, walked the walk.
Absolutely.
He was a very spiritual guy and a great mentor.
He was a really kind guy too, Ray.
Yes, he was.
And didn't mind, you know, like in the times I got to interview him, you know, he would talk really openly about just all the history of the door stuff, and it was so interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and all the mystical stuff that they were into. I mean, he truly believed it, and I think that's if you're going to talk that way, then you got to be that way.
Yeah.
And we were a little skeptical maybe, but then we were seeing who he was and started thinking, oh, well, maybe he's onto something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I believe it much more.
That's he certainly did a great job. We definitely miss him, and he told me the story about how he. They couldn't, like, the first demos were all piano because they couldn't afford an organ back then. I mean, they got signed to Columbia Records, a singles deal, and Columbia said they won't put it out. He goes, oh, well, you're going to sign us and give us some money. And they go, no money. He goes, well, how about some equipment? And so that's how he ended up getting the organ.
Wow.
It was from Columbia Records. And then they dropped him, and then Elektra picked him up, and probably Columbia was probably regretted it from that moment on. Pretty funny story.
Well, unfortunately, probably whoever dropped him didn't get fired, which they should have.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a record company, so.
So a lot of people fell upward.
Yeah. You can't get fired.
Yeah, it's crazy when I look back. Yeah. Hey, can you talk to me about the first time that you guys went to the East Coast? Because, it was such a different way of communicating back then. And, of course, you guys did CBGBs and Max's. You were the first band from L.A. to play there. Do you remember back in 1978 what that was like to go to New York? Yeah. Exene?
Well, it was a comedy of errors because we didn't have anywhere to play in between. So our first tour was New York.
Yeah.
Period. Like, it was like, okay, so we're going to play some shows in New York, then we're going to drive back to Los Angeles. That was all there was. And then somebody came to see us play, and they said, well, you can play in Philadelphia, and you can play at this other place in Pennsylvania. So we picked up two more gigs, and what was amazing about it was the ancient days of the 70s, 80s era when the America still was unchanged from 40 years prior. I mean, it was just like driving across the country was great. We had a very broken down vehicle, and we were always either on fire or stalled out on the Brooklyn Bridge or something. It was terrible, but we did it. And we played those shows. It was really neat to play Max's. And I still have my little scrapbook from that. And I have the Max's Kansas City menu that has, like, everybody's names, like, the dishes. It was really a big deal. I think that's when we met the Cramps too. It might have been another time when I was in New York visiting my sister, but I remember meeting the Cramps at CBGB's. Yeah. But it was, you know, the dream come true stuff, but it was so grueling and so hard, and we ended up losing money, and our car got towed away, and that's when I wrote Your Phone's Off the Hook, because also one of the bands that we were playing with, they called us up to see when we were coming by to pick up their equipment. Since we were opening, we had a vehicle, we could come pick up their equipment and transport it for them. And John said, no, we're not going to do that. We have our own equipment. We don't have room. They got very angry with us and hung up. So I said, your phone's off the hook, but you're not. And then they towed away our vehicle and said, all of New York is a tow-away zone. So that's in the song. So that song kind of paid for the trip, I guess, all things considered.
Yes. Yeah, what a great song, too. On the first album. So that was, were the Cramps really cool to hang with at that point? Lux and Ivy?
You know, I thought that they were like really, really nice people. And I know people always say that about me too. It's like they're really terrified of me and all this stuff. And we're all kind of pretty much just regular people who play music or whatever. But they were definitely, for me, the scariest band of all time. Like Brian Gregory, just him alone, not to mention that whole band. Like you just look at them and you'd be like, because they just had this kind of monster rock terrifying presence, but they were just so real at the same time. They were somewhat theatrical, but also just really real. And of course they were very nice people.
Yeah, Lux was certainly the Superman of punk rock.
Yeah.
Because he was in the day, by day, mild-mannered Clark Kent.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he hit the stage, it was just like, where did this come from? But,
yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of people, they have this alter ego.
Yeah.
I remember them playing the Hootenanny, which used to happen down in Orange County.
Yeah.
And my daughters were there. They were pretty young. Lux ripped the entire crotch out of his pants and his junk was hanging out. And my daughters were like, you know, 6 and 8, and just trying to put my hands over their eyes. But he did this amazing thing where I'd seen him do this before, where he took a mic stand and bent it over his shoulders. So it was in an L-shaped straight stand, right?
Yeah.
Then he put it on top of another like boom stand, and then took so that it was tipping back and forth. Then took a wine bottle, tipped it up the bottom of the mic stand. If you can imagine this, took took the mic cable and wrapped it around, lashed the mic the wine bottle to the mic stand, then let it go, and it went like up and down and up and down. And then he laid down underneath of it. So the wine would be going into his mouth as it rocked back and forth. It's like, and he didn't practice this. Yeah. He didn't say, okay, guys, now when we're doing the middle part of Surfin' Bird, I'm going to like, he just was out of his, you know, he was in his Lux interior grandness.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this thing. When we did that Erg a Music War, somebody threw a high top sneaker onto the stage. He picked up a bottle of champagne and poured champagne into the sneaker and then drank it like drinking champagne out of a woman's shoe.
Yeah.
But there was this nasty old Converse freaking all-star high top. Like, he was genius. He was so mild-mannered.
Yeah.
And but when you see those interviews when they're like walking around in record stores and talking about that, they were so into obscure stuff and music history and really smart, well-spoken and
The antecedent or whatever you would call to that would be Hazel Atkins.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, because it was kind of that same psychobilly kind of thing, you know.
Anything goes.
I mean, all rock, most rockabilly was psychobilly, if you think, I mean, if you listen to that stuff.
Yeah.
It was very rural and very crazy people, like very, like, out there kind of stuff. So I think they found themselves in that and then just took it all the way to the limit of where it could go.
It's great when you hear those old recordings too. I mean, Johnny Burnett Trio, Rock and Roll Trio.
Oh,
when you hear Train Kept a Rollin' and the howling on that and the distortion on the guitar.
Yeah.
It's one of the greatest recordings of all time. I mean, I love that so much.
Because you can hear them hooting and hollering in the background. Yeah. Same with some of the Gene Vincent records and things like that.
Yeah,
pretty amazing.
Absolutely love that, and I'm glad that it kind of gave birth to a return to that. With
probably the best thing about technology is that all the music didn't get completely lost, because, you know, when you go on YouTube and you go from thing to thing and you just start looking and you see some woman you've never heard of who's a blues singer from 1930, and it's got 80,000 views. And you're like, she didn't have 80,000 views in her lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, how neat is that? Like, and all these young people now, they're learning how to play 20s music and all this old music from being able to find it, the technology. And then people can take their record collections and play them for the world now. And so that, to me, is the, you know, that's the best thing about technology, right?
Yes, it's connecting people to the, to that art,
yeah,
to that music.
And that, and that's, we didn't have that. So Billy always tells a story famously of him going into Tower Records, and who knows if this is true, going into Tower Records and asking if he could, if they had a Little Richard record, and they threw him out and chased him down the street, which I think is an exaggeration. But the point is, they did not sell Little Richard records at Tower Records in 1978 or whatever. So.
Which is, it's crazy when you think about it. You would think because of those, you know, the real forefathers of rock and roll.
Well, they didn't, they were out of print. I mean, there wasn't, they didn't exist. The thing is like the Charlie Records came along and started reissuing all that stuff. And that, talk once about again, rockabilly.
Once again, the English are selling our music back to us.
Well, they're,
right? That's it, Charlie Records. Well, like, the reissue labels, like all of those, right?
Yeah, but you know what?
They're great.
God bless them.
They, they're really good at everything they do. That they've Chad and Jeremy, come on.
Yeah, but the...
Yeah.
Let's hear it for Chad and Jeremy.
They're great. Yeah. Well, you know that new wave kind of stuff that the English did that I never really cared for is awful good now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mean hearing it again now? Like at this point, hearing the second
phase?
Yeah,
it's like, wow, that was pretty clever when they did that, you know?
Yeah, because it was all different at that period of time.
Yeah, everybody was, you know, I was just resentful because they could get on the radio and we couldn't.
Yeah, which I love because in I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, there's definitely like, there's you know, in the lyrics to that when you're talking
about British invasion.
Yeah, about all the American.
The other one.
That was crabby.
Yeah.
That was just bratty.
And now, of course, you know, like you said, it's well, everything gets, you know, different with a different perspective.
Yes, it does.
As you get older.
Live long enough, everything gets either really bad or really good.
Yeah, so...
They all switch places. The bad becomes the good becomes the bad. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes it does. I'm here with John Doe and Xena. We're really excited because the new album is coming out on August 2nd. It's the final album, Smoking Fiction. You guys work with Rob Schnapp again, and that, he's done some great stuff. How do you like working with him as a producer? Was he... Do you feel like he really got? Was he a big fan of the bands in the past? He did Alphabet Land too, but
yeah, he sort of auditioned maybe for us because we were particular about what sort of producer engineer we work with, and we had toured with Pearl Jam in 2012, and you know Pearl Jam records all of their live shows.
Yeah,
and then the fans trade them and all this kind of stuff. It's a bit like the Grateful Dead. And they were good enough to record all of our shows with them. We played South America. We played in Europe as well. And so they gave us access to those tapes, and we did a GoFundMe kind of thing where if we reached a certain goal, then we'd be able to... One of the rewards was getting this record of live stuff. And Rob mixed that.
Yeah.
He produced and mixed that. So we thought, okay, well, now we have a producer... So we have one thing checked off the list, and then we got our masters back and wanted to reissue them, and Fat Possum said, okay, we'll give you a good deal. So Fat Possum, which is a great label based on you know, some older blues players from freaking Mississippi, R.L. Burnside and Junior Kimbrough, which is like, what kind of a business model is that?
Yeah, R.L. Burnside, that stuff is...
You're signing someone who's in his late 50s or early 60s that nobody knows and plays like this wild-ass blues.
Yeah, I remember his S-Pocket Full of Whiskey and the stuff that came out a little...
I love that.
I love it.
But anyway, so we had two boxes checked.
Which,
So, okay, well, let's do a new record. Yes. And that's how we got involved with Rob. And he is quietly... demanding, but in the best way,
because
very he's really positive.
He wants to
capture the joy that is there, and sometimes that's hard because you're just working away, but this record happened really quickly.
Spent
3 days doing basic tracks, and Xena did our vocals in 3 or 4 days, and like that Big Black X song, we sort of made that in the studio. We'd never played it live, and some of the other songs we did play live for about a year or so.
We're going to hear Ruby Church. Tell me about
that. I wanted to say that just hearing John say that, Rob is so much like Ray. because Ray was the same way. He could be really tough if it was like, knock it off. This is forever. You're going to sing this song and stop, you know, do this, you know, or whatever. But also really fun and smart and intuitive. And it, so you feel this relaxed feeling like this, that, hey, this guy's cool and he's one of us. But then you realize, but he's also in charge. And so, and he always would just, Rob would say all these really great suggestions to me. Like, you know, that last line, I go, yeah, and he goes, don't try too hard. I go, oh, got it. It clicks in my mind. Yes, I was trying too hard. And then I sing it and he goes, that's it. You know, he's just, he's really understands us. He really did. Yeah. He does. He really knows. But if I was like, you know what, Rob, can we just go down the street for 10 minutes and play pinball? He'd be like, sure, let's do that.
Yeah,
because he's just like, he knows what whatever makes gonna make the record great.
Anyway. And give you a chance to decompress and
yeah,
just take a minute.
You know, I mean, he's a peer, and but he's really smart. I mean, he's pretty much a genius too. You know, but anyway. So what were you going
to
ask?
I was going to say, talk to me about Ruby Church, the opening track on the record.
Was that the opening track? I was like, no, that has to be the first song. It has to be the first song. It's like that's the first song.
Yeah. So it's, tell me about it.
Well, it started as a poem. And I was inspired by our friendship with Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
And his superpower was joy. Yeah. His superpower was laughter. And he could get into all these, say all these things and get people to think of all these very heavy subjects but in a way that was humorous, in a way that wasn't threatening, you know, and so, but he still had that glint in his eye, and the lyrics of this song are about that. So someone is being judged in a church. I don't know where the Ruby Church came from, but and then the music, but that person's superpower, even though there are these forces of judgment that are put on him, he just stands his ground and he has a smile on his face. So it's like, it's F you, but it's not in a mean way. It's in a like, you can't touch me. I'm me. I'm gonna stay strong.
Yeah.
The music went through a bunch of different permutations, whatever the word would be. It went through a bunch of changes, and we finally settled on this. And it's a little tricky. It's got a little like half measure somewhere in the verse and but it's to the point. I think it's 2 minutes and 19 seconds long.
Yeah.
So you can't go to the bathroom if you're a DJ while you're playing Ruby Church. Sorry.
Absolutely. That's all right. I went before, and certainly I think DJs, we appreciate. Yeah. And always, if you love the punk rock and all the old 60s garage rock and all the old, you know, songs.
Yeah, you got to hold your water.
You got to hold your water. Let's check it out right now. Smoking Fiction is the album. I'm in studio with John Doe and Xene, and this is Ruby Church on the SoCal Sound. And there it is. 4th of July, going back to the album See How We Are. And there isn't a year that doesn't go by that I haven't played that since it was released.
Yep. Yeah,
and I'm sure you guys know that. Tell me, I've read conflicting stories about how you ended up doing this song, and Dave Alvin wrote. Tell me about how that happened.
Well, Billy had kind of had enough. We did Ain't Love Grand and just toured and toured and toured, and it was exhausting. And so he said, you know what, I've got to just take a break. And Dave Alvin was a little bit unhappy being in the Blasters, so we just switched guitar players.
Yeah,
I mean, Dave started playing with us first, and then later on, the Blasters asked Billy to tour in Europe, I think. But Dave had written the song, and he said, "Well, we could do this song if I'm going to be in the band. You know, maybe you want to do some of my songs." And we said, "Well, this is an incredible song. Of course, we want to do it." And then after we recorded the whole record, then Dave said, you know, Phil has been singing my songs since the beginning. Phil Alvin, his brother.
Yeah.
And now you're going to sing my songs? I don't think so. I think I'm going to sing my own songs, and I don't want to be in the band anymore. We're like, what? No, we just made the record. But Tony Gilkison had also come in to play guitar. So Dave was smart. He said, I'm just going to do my own songs. I'm going to sing my own songs. And he did a great version of it, too. So
yeah.
You have to play those back to back. It'll be a two for
yeah.
two.
One of these days Tuesday. I'll do that for him. And, you know, you've...
Two
but you guys
Tuesday.
All knew each other from that scene coming up, which is amazing.
Yeah, we did the band The Knitters, and, yeah. and the Blasters played with us countless times.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're an amazing band.
Yeah,
amazing
and Marie was such a great tune. And then, of course, that guy in England, Shakin' Stevens, covered their song. But I hope yeah. they made some money off it. Cause,
oh, yeah, they did.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to see that happen for them just because what sure. a great tune. The original that they did with The Blasters was great. Tell me about those, when you guys finally started playing, like the Starwood in the early, you know, and the Hong Kong Cafe. What was it like? What was the initial reactions like, Exene? What was it?
What do you mean from the crowd?
Yeah, from the crowd. Then did the audience find you guys there? What was it like?
You know, I don't know exactly how that all happened. That there was no phones or internet or film or mainstream coverage of anything, and everybody found each other just miraculously everywhere we went, all over the country. But. The early days of the Starwood and all those clubs were great because it would be packed with people just having a really great, amazing, fun time. Like when we would go see bands, we'd go see Devo or Television or whoever was in town and Blondie or whatever, Damned. It was just super fun on stage. It was super fun in the audience, and everybody kind of seemed like they were still kind of all switching positions. Like in The Mask, half the audience would play and the other half would be watching. And then yeah. we'd just switch positions, you know. I think that by this time the Starwood was happening, there was more audience, you know, more people finding it. Yeah. It was just really thrilling and exciting and fun and electric. And you just knew you were in the right place at the right time, and so was everyone else. And it was just completely freedom, joyous, you know.
It did take
magic.
Yeah, it did take a couple years or a year, at least a year, where they, you know, Brendan Mullen would be putting on shows at The Mask, and then that would get shut down, and then they would rent a hall down in Larchmont, and, you know, mayhem would happen, and then yeah. we wouldn't be able to go back to that hall. And then we'd find another one, and then it became a thing, became a scene. Yeah. People would hear word of mouth, and then there were more people and this and that. And then with the LA Weekly and the LA Reader, free papers, and then Slash Magazine, then it was like, go out and see something. And once Christine McKenna and the LA Times and some other writers around town would start saying, you know what, there is absolutely great live music in your city. You don't have to just listen to what's given to you by the commercial radio station. You can find you will find a band that you love. So just go. Yeah. And here are the clubs. There's Club 88. There's the Hong Kong Cafe. There's the Music Machine. There's the Vex down in East LA, there's this and there's that, Al's Bar downtown, la. And it became a groundswell. So like any like good scene.
Yeah.
Minneapolis was like that, you know, with Prince and The Time and
yeah,
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the all those, you know, Husker Du, obviously, Replacements, all the people out of that period, right, yeah. later. But yeah, so what was it like when you guys played Disneyland, you put Magic Mountain. So they're like, that, what was that?
Well, every year those places would hire a band to play at the like prom thing or whatever. I don't know. I never went to school. I never went to Disneyland. I had no idea. It was just like get in the van. So yeah, you would just play, and they'd give you a bunch of money, and then you'd go drink, and that was that.
The coolest thing was when the Blasters and X played at Disneyland one time.
Yeah.
We would meet in the tunnels underneath, you know, underneath Disneyland.
Yeah.
And I remember Gene Taylor, rest his soul, down there, and Gene was a Blasters piano player, and he always wore these Ray-Ban dark glasses. He looked like such a beatnik. He always wore one of those little, like, sort of, plaid hats, you know, a little like snap brim hat.
Cap, like Al Capone. Like Andy
a cap and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up to his elbows and these khaki pants and these dark glasses and a little goatee. And he just like he looked like a, you know, he just walked out of Jack Kerouac's kitchen or something like that.
Yeah.
And he did acid all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, all the time. Playing this crazy boogie woogie piano, and he'd say, John, you know, like, the keyboard was like in waves. It was going up and down and up and down, but I knew that I could keep doing it. And we were in the tunnels of Disneyland, And Gene's acting kind of strange, and he takes his sunglasses off for a minute, and his eyes look like lobster eyes. They're just going like, whoa, whoa. And he's just tripping his ass off in the tunnels of Disneyland. You're going, cool.
Yeah, that's let's amazing.
Let's go play some rockabilly and some punk rock. Blow these kids' minds.
That's amazing.
Well, that's because you couldn't do any other kind of drug in that Disney area.
No.
Yeah.
You couldn't smoke cigarettes. You couldn't drink. You couldn't. Yeah. They had police spies everywhere in the walls.
Great magic. Yeah. But it was a lot of fun, right? I mean, it's great. Yeah. So this summer tour, you know, I got to say, the Solo Troubadour show is coming up, but we're pumped about that. But I love the region shows, and you're playing all over. You're playing. Mm-hmm.
We have a bunch of shows coming up in Southern California. We have that Regent place.
Yeah.
A couple nights. We have the Belly Up, which is their anniversary this year, so that's really cool.
Great venue there by Carlsbad.
I love that place. And then, you know, things just happen sometimes. Like, John and I just finished opening a bunch of shows for the Psychedelic Furs. So you just never know. Like, sometimes people just call up and say, is X available? Let's do a show or whatever. Open for us. But it's always exciting because you never know what's coming. But there are a lot of shows coming up that people can get to. And then we are touring as much as we possibly can while we still can for the rest of the year. So, you know, we're talking a lot about the East Coast and all the fun times back there. And we're going to make it back there, too. So that'll be fun.
I think that's in September. And then the South is in October. The West and Northwest is in August. And we're doing the Midwest in July. So, we're going to be hitting it pretty hard.
That's great.
And then we'll be back here in December to play more. We always play around Christmas time.
And we're doing
time.
The Orange County
Yes, so
Orange
that'll
Fair,
be fun.
Right?
I love doing that one.
The Orange County Fair is great. So two gigs in Los Angeles.
Yes, lots.
Is
Costa Mesa.
Reverend Horton Heat is opening that?
Supposedly, yeah. We'll see.
You guys gonna have the Rev. That'll be great. Mm-hmm. He's always great live too.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing Menlo Park, and we have listeners everywhere. I mean, literally all over
sure,
the world.
Right?
Wide web.
Yeah.
Two nights in Menlo Park, which is, I guess it's San Jose area, kind of San Francisco area. All that area is kind of the same
Valley.
Area. Anyway,
Silicon Valley, so,
That place, The Guild, is a really cool place to see a show. It's like a small little theater, and it's really, really nice.
Yeah, that's
like old-fashioned. It's cool.
That is so great, and we're excited about it, and it's just really cool that this new album is going to be out on August 2nd, and, people can also... I'm sure there's going to be vinyl, and there'll be some...
Oh, yeah.
There's already vinyl. People are buying vinyl. That was a special thing that we sold some of.
Test presses.
Yes, a special thing for special people.
And I think there's pre-sale. There's some different colors of vinyl. There's pre-sale that's going on, I think, the middle of July.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, and I love if Fat Possum put out the first four albums again. It's a great label.
It is a great label, and they're really smart.
Yeah. I mean, really they've signed some cool bands over the last, 15, 20 years, too, as well.
Yeah.
You know, like yourselves.
And you can go see the X-Billboard over in Silver Lake on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, you got to go check it out.
That is cool.
It's right above a car wash. I mean, how L.A. can you get?
It's perfect, right?
Yeah.
Is it a car wash that's actually open and still functioning, though?
It's a, wash-it-yourself car wash.
Yeah. Those are great. But listen, I want to just say, I want to thank you for coming in and hanging out with us today.
It's always a pleasure, Matt.
Yeah, it's great to see you, John, and good to see you again, Ixine. And mm-hmm. I'm excited about the shows on the road. Once again, everybody, the new album, 10 new songs, is coming out on the date is August 2nd.
Smoking Fiction.
Coming right up.
It sounds great.
It's happening. I'm getting excited.
Yeah, and we're gonna play a song. Right, we're gonna leave everybody with a song from More Fun in the New World. Great song called I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. Guys, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great to have you. John Doe and Ixine from X right here at 85 to SoCal Sound.
The SoCal Sound sessions are produced by 88.5 FM, the SoCal Sound. Session hosted by Matt Pinfield. Recorded and mixed by Tristan Dolce. Edited by Matt Blake. The SoCal Sound is a public service of California State University Northridge and Saddleback College, broadcasting over the air at 88.5 FM and streaming on the web and through our app at thesocalsound.org.